If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Wherever you're listening, this podcast is sponsored by Cooker 100 Degree, boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. People always ask me if they're safe. Yes, they are, I always say. They have a push and turn mechanism on the tap, which means kids can't scald themselves and some adults can't use it either. They come around my house and I tell them what to do and they're like, Not at the moment though, because we're obviously in lockdown, so no one's coming over. For more information, go to cooker.co.uk. Today, I'm going to have a conversation with friend of the podcast, Matthew Syed. As you know, Matthew was Britain's number one table tennis player who became a journalist and an author after he retired. He has previously published four excellent books, Bounce, Black Box Thinking, You Are Awesome, and Rebel Ideas, The Power of Diverse Thinking. His latest book is called Dare to Be You. He also used to have that excellent podcast, didn't he, with Freddie Flintoff and Robbie Savage. I used to enjoy listening to that, but it seems to have stopped a couple of years ago. I don't know why. Well, let's find out. Let's meet him. Here he is. This is Matthew. Hi, Matthew. How are you?
Tim, I'm good. Where are you, by the way? I think the last time we did a podcast together, I came to your home, which isn't far from where I live in southwest London. But yeah, are you there now?
I'm still in my kitchen, but now we do it over Zoom. So exciting stuff. But I've just in my intro talked about your podcast you did with Freddie Flintoff and Robbie Savage, which is no longer. What happened there? Because that was a great podcast.
And you know, I loved doing it, to be honest, but Fred got a presenting role on Top Gear, travelled a lot. It was very difficult to coordinate diaries. But Rob and I have started recording some podcasts, Robbie Savage and I. So we have about six in the can now, and I think we're going to launch sometime next year. But Fred, we couldn't get him involved. He's got too big for us, Tim. He's too big.
How's the lockdown for you? How's writing been in the lockdown?
Yeah, I think the first one in March, that was quite tough, to be honest, because our kids, we got an 8 and a 6-year-old, they were at home, you know what I mean? And it's difficult to focus and to get a bit of quiet and a bit of solitude. So that was tough. I think easier this time because schools are open. Mm. But I'm really bored of it, Tim. I'm just so thankful that there's a vaccine is coming down the tracks and, yeah, we might get back to some form of normality next year. What about you?
Yeah, well, the show's been fine because we've been able to do Sunday brunch. And I took a bit of time away from this podcast, actually, because I was slightly disillusioned with myself and the world and slightly down. But this time I've just carried on and I'm enjoying doing the podcast this time round. So I think there's lots of interesting things to talk about.
What did you get down about, just generally?
Yeah,
I
didn't like it. I didn't like not being around humans and I didn't like having my freedom taken away. And I value my freedom more than ever now. And it's one of the things that when we come out at the end of this, we've got to ensure that we get our freedom back because I'm finding it slightly, I don't know, I say to my kids and constantly, when I grew up, I was so free. There was not that many laws and rules around, you know. It's like, I mean, there was mad stuff like you could ride a motorbike without a helmet, drive a car without a seatbelt. I'm not saying we should do that now, but now every little bit of your life is micromanaged. And, you know, you get in a car now. It used to be, was there a policeman there? Now there's cameras everywhere and things are changing. So your life is, as you move around, you're being more managed, more and more managed and less free. Now, some of it obviously has major advantages, like we can keep the speed limit down on the roads. But the flip side of it is that we are being controlled more and more. You leave your front door it's not your choice is what you're doing anymore, a bit.
The one thing that gets me a bit, and I think it's a mistake strategically, is in terms of politics, is the number of different sort of guidelines and demands. And, you know, you should have this number of units of alcohol, you need to do this in this way and that in that way. Two things that worry me about it. One, we're all different. Yeah. You know, we have different aspirations, we have different genetics. You know, in terms of diet, we have different gut microbiomes. The idea there is a standardized way of eating and living that fits all of us, I think, is a mistake. But the other thing is, it's almost like there's a denial of death. You know, drinking alcohol, I don't drink that much, but I don't want to come across an alcoholic or anything. But having a few drinks is a great part of what makes life fun. You know, takes the edge off a stressful day. And when you get this sort of didactic top-down, you shouldn't drink at all because you would be able to live on average, you know, an extra 6 months. You know, we're all going to die at some point. I hate to say this early on in the podcast, but we will all die. The question isn't how can I endlessly extend life? The question is how can I live a meaningful and fulfilling life? And some of the things we do, they're not necessarily the most healthy. You know, they're not the kind of things that would fit into a, you know, kind of an epidemiological model of how one should live. But sometimes, you know, you just want to do things and not have government experts giving you quite, I think, quite didactic advice on how you should live. I think we've gone too far down that track.
I'm going to regret saying this, but what bugs me, if we're talking about death, we are all going to death. It's still 100% death rate in this country. But the one thing which grates me is when people say, if it just saves one life, then if you take that, follow that theory through, then we should just get rid of cars because, right. And we should get rid of aeroplanes because every now and then they fall out of the sky. Let's get rid of boats, horse riding, that kills people. You know, let's get rid of any form of drug because that can kill people, even legal ones. I mean, it's such a weird thing to say because, you know, there has to be a certain amount of death. And I think the big thing which people have found out during this coronavirus, and I don't want to make this into a joke, but I think people have just realized that people do die. And when people are shown figures constantly on TV about death rate, it's like, wow, people are dying in this country. It's like, oh, no shit. We're also having people born every year as well, or every day as well. And it is something which is happening.
I mean, I think obviously it's a fairly obvious point, but one distinction in a pandemic is any risk I take on myself, you know, I'm prepared to go out and do something that I might get infected. It can potentially create a risk for others through chains of transmission. So I think there is a distinction between a pandemic style risk and a risk that I take onto myself by having a fry up twice a week, which I still do and absolutely love, and it's probably the worst thing that you get. But all I was going to say, Tim, is that, you know, when they say if no one drank any alcohol, we would save 10,000 lives a year, it's actually a bit of it's a deceptive statistic, because as you said, for every birth there is exactly one death. That ratio never changes and never will change. What they really mean by saying we will save 10,000 lives is that we will delay 10,000 deaths. The death will still happen, but just artificially extending life, but without doing the things that we enjoy, that, it seems to me, is a very false argument.
There are more births than deaths, though, Matthew, because the population of the world has doubled in my lifetime.
Right, but there's still one death for every birth.
Oh, I see. All right, one death. I thought you said one birth for every death. Yeah, there is one death for every birth. You are right on that. Yeah, true. Actually, it's an interesting point talking about journalism. Let's talk about that, because you are a journalist. You do write for The Times. Do you call yourself a journalist or a writer?
I used to call myself a ping pong player years ago. What would I call myself as that? Journalist. Journalist and author.
We'll talk about your book in a minute, because that's what I want to talk to you about. But it's interesting. I've been looking at journalism during this pandemic and thinking about it. The way journalism sets up is poor, isn't it? Because the way to be a good journalist is by getting clicks or ratings. And the way to do that is become extreme and take sides and have an opinion. So we've gone from, and I think it's probably always been there because you got to sell newspapers years ago. Now you're getting clicks. Obviously, you still work for a newspaper, but you're trying to get clicks online. But it seems to me these days that the job of a journalist, you have to be outspoken. If you're not outspoken, then you're not going to get recognized, which means you have to have an opinion and die on that hill of your opinion. So you're not asking the right questions sometimes, or you may be asking the right questions, but people won't, because they want to stick to what their opinion is to get the ratings going.
So I think that is a not unfair characterization of the way a lot of people think within the media about how the media should operate. In other words, if you're trying to optimize for clicks, so in an online world, you want as many people to click as possible. And obviously in a print world, you want as many people to buy a newspaper as possible. And what you can do is measure those headlines and stories that get maximum clicks, and therefore you get more advertising revenue. And that is why people want to have very shouty headlines and very sensationalistic stories and very extreme views, which are amplified on the internet. But it's a flawed conception of what the media should be doing, Tim, because the more you put these sensationalist headlines out, the more extreme the opinion, the less trustworthy you appear as a source of information. And in a complex world with pandemics and all sorts of other things going on, what I think will distinguish the great media operations of the future is being a trusted source of information and knowledge. People need that. And by going for sensationalist clicks, they get a short-term uplift in advertising revenue, but a short-term detriment in trust. And at some point, these two things collide. And I want I write for the Times and the Sunday Times. My argument internally, and I think this is, I think the Times and the Sunday Times are certainly amongst the most responsible of newspapers with a balance of views. I mean, I write a political column for the Sunday Times. I'm sort of center left in, Rod Little is more to the right, and we have, it's quite a broad spectrum in the Times as well. But I think having authoritative, in other words, don't be aligned with a political party. We're going to go with the Tories or we're with Labour. It should be, let's look at the issue. Let's genuinely try and think about what the right answer, and then try and provide that information to the reader online or in print. And I think that is a better business model in the long run. Because remember, Tim, at the moment on the social media, it's just built for the application of extreme views. Massive polarization, left and right, COVID skeptics and COVID idiots, the lockdown people and the free spread of the virus. You take any topic and you have this massive divide of people, as you say, who want to identify as the person who is the lockdown skeptic. And then you just marshal all the arguments in favor of your position and defame everybody else. Yeah, that'll get you a bit of publicity, but you'll never have a long-term business model with that approach.
Apart from the Daily Mail, which is going for clicks and is the most successful online online publication, isn't it, in the world at the moment?
But Tim, remember, the Mail Online is effectively creating the clicks through gossip, isn't it? Through human interest, through pictures of celebrities and other things. But if you're talking about what you might call the information gathering press, I think it's a completely different idea. I think there is clearly a market for gossip, and the Daily Mail is Mail Online, I should call it.
Yeah, which one has the biggest impact though? And the biggest impact has, let's put a load of bikinis down the sideline, made in Chelsea, and the only way is Essex, and America in America, their versions of that. And then on the left-hand side, we can put politics and hit you with politics. And it's a big impact if you're going down the right-hand side, and on the left-hand side, they've got, a really interesting case of that, which, if we talk about impact, Marcus Rashford, like the absolute hero of 2020, no one is denying that. What a great man, could just play football, get on with it. He's making his money. He's a good player and everything else. But he decides to put his head out, all right? He's put his head out of the parapet and he's done. Now, everyone's gone amazing. Look what he's done. And it only takes a week before a journalist thinks, I can get more clicks here if I start investigating Marcus Rashford. So they say he's bought some houses. Now, every single footballer of profile and journalists for profile have waded in on Twitter about it. All the Daily Mail Online are doing, going, that worked. Right, what next? Prince Harry. Oh, that worked. What's next? It's like, that's their model. So it works.
But think about television. I mean, you know, so I think there is a clear human, and I think this is probably cross-cultural. We are massive inveterate gossipers. And this probably started evolving at least 200,000 years ago. But once we started living in social groups, we had to start tracking what other people were doing. We wanted to understand how people related to other people. It was part of how we managed to navigate a social world. And I do think television and the media has become very, very gossipy. I think that's true. I think, you know, we've always, and I think that, you know, an interest, a kind of salacious interest in how other people are living, what they're doing, what nightclub they fell out of at 3 a.m. I suspect it's going to be, I don't think that will ever change. I think humans will always be interested in that. But I do think when it comes to information about important issues like pandemics and politics and economics and education and schooling, health, there is a massive niche for really trusted providers of information. And I really think that the media, remember, it's expensive to run a newspaper, Tim, because you've got to hire people who work full time and are prepared to invest their time in creating building stories, investigative ones and otherwise. And I think the only way to do that is you've got to have very high levels of trust. And I do worry that we in the media mustn't squander it.
Matthew, I wish I had your faith after watching the election over here and watching the election in the United States and watching politicians just blatantly lie and don't care about it and they're not trustworthy. Then it seems these days, just say something. Oh, actually, I want to ask you something else just on being a journalist. Do you feel you have to defend your opinion more? I seem to see a lot of journalists at the moment having to come online and either go, look, this is why I'm saying this, or I apologize because I used a phrase or a sentence which was deemed something, I don't know, not PC or whatever. Do you find that you're having to explain yourself more?
My approach is I don't tweet. I mean, I started quite late in Twitter. I say quite late in Twitter. It's probably a few years ago now. But I remember everyone telling me, why are you not on Twitter? And I eventually got on. And occasionally, I think typically most people sort of get it if you use the wrong word or if. So I don't tend to self-justify that much on Twitter. Once I did trend because I wrote a column about a football coach who had been accused of being racist. And I made the point on Twitter that even though racism is obviously a terrible thing, I say that as somebody from a mixed race background, due process is also very important. And we can't have this person sacked without some independent investigation to see if the claims of racism are true. But online, people started saying, oh, he's defending racism. Yeah. I was trying to defend this person's right to a fair hearing, and I started trending. And the interesting thing, too, actually, this is worth saying, you know, a lot of people who hadn't, because the Times and the Sunday Times are behind a paywall, a lot of people haven't read the article.
Yeah.
They've just read a couple of people writing a particular line from the article. And so a lot of people were calling for me to be sacked. So I can imagine why journalists are nervous about getting on the wrong end of a Twitter pilot, because I think some have lost it. I mean, I think New York Times, there's a number of examples of where people have gone in the wrong end of a Twitter pylon and then ended up losing their jobs. Luckily, the sports editor of the I think it was a sports column, the sports editor of the Times, either didn't see the pylon or wasn't particularly bothered about it.
You know what? I'm terrified doing this podcast sometimes. I mean, Sunday brunch is all right because, you know, I've been doing it for so long. It's, you know, you're only ever one word away from losing your job these days, one sentence. Though with this podcast, because I talk openly and it's a longer conversation, I suddenly find I'll wake up one night and go, oh my God, did I really say that? Oh God, how's that be construed? Then I listen back and it's completely benign, but I'm so terrified of saying the wrong thing. And then everyone's saying, well, he's a this or a that or something, you know?
I think it's incredibly unfair. So by the way, I've written at least a dozen columns on this terrain. I think it's absolutely outrageous when you take a word or sentence of an email or a conversation, you post it and think that that you're trying to insinuate that that is representative of a person's character. Mm. I find it incredible that people are prepared to do that. Now, what a sentence means, yes. You take it, especially on live TV. Sunday brunch is live, isn't it?
Yeah.
On live TV, when I'm guessing, are having to think about what you're about to throw to on VT. You're listening to someone's answer. You're trying to think about what the next question will be. You've got the gallery in your ear. I mean, I've done a tiny bit of live TV, and I'm amazed how few gaffes there are, because you build the ability, right, to multitask. It's an amazing thing to watch. And when somebody gets criticized for saying one word out of context or slightly wrong, and they apologize, and then they have to resign or be sacked anyway, I think that's incredibly unfair, because when you think about it, we spend our lives building our reputations. We go to school, we learn what we need to know. And then if that can disappear, all of that work, in the time it takes for one sentence taken out of context to go viral via the arbitrary gyrations of, you know, the online media, I think that's a real violation of natural justice. So I try and stick up for anyone whose reputation is being eviscerated. You know, do it after a proper look at who this person is, what their character says, what their overall track record is. If somebody says the N-word, actually, it's a different example. Let's say someone said something that seemed off color about gender. And then you looked at their, you know, and they're on live TV, they got a bit flustered, and actually they apologize and they say, look at my whole life, what I've done in this terrain and who I am. That's the way we should measure people, not on single sentences. It's an outrageous thing to do.
I agree. And the other side to this, which is interesting, is I'm very conscious of privilege as well. So I said that I was depressed on my show during the first lockdown. Said I was struggling. I got unbelievable amount of tweets from people saying, thank God someone like you said it, because I feel the same way. Well, it was about 2.5 months in. I was really, really dragging, and I was really struggling. And, you know, I've had my fair share of mental health problems, but I was aware that I had a job, I have money, I have a house, you know, I have children, blah, blah, blah. So I realized that I'm privileged. And that is one of the problems with doing something like the podcast. Connie Huck and me were discussing the other day how money doesn't bring you happiness. And I had to say to her, it's really easy for us to say that because we've got a bit of money. We've got a car, we've got a house. And so it's so hard if you put, you know, I'm a white man, you call me, I don't know what you call me, middle class, I'm in it. Uneducated, but I am, and I've got a job and a good job. And so it's really hard for me to make any comments at the moment, because the major backlash is, what have you got to worry about? Why can you have an opinion on this?
Yeah, do you know, it's interesting this, but the fact that you are aware that the kind of the context in which you live gives you a perspective that might be different to somebody who is living in a tower block and hasn't got access to the football club that they go to once a week and is a wonderful release. You know, it may well be that if you've got a huge garden and you can play football in the back garden, you know, the lockdown isn't going to affect you as bad as, and you've got a brilliant internet connection, it's not going to affect you as bad as someone living in a tower block who that one run around outside per week with a mentor who's, and by the way, I think understanding how diversity of experience and viewpoint is really useful in understanding things. That's what governments have often lacked. You know, I remember the poll tax. I did quite a deep study on the poll tax for one of my books. And it was basically almost everyone who designed the poll tax, they didn't have bad intentions. They were just all from aristocratic backgrounds. You know, William Waldegrave grew up on a huge manor in rural Oxfordshire, and Nick Ridley, the environment secretary, again, from the aristocratic, from Northumberland in his case. And all of them, when they were talking about how this policy would actually impact people, they didn't have the experiences to understand what would it mean for somebody trying to pay the poll tax from a poor background. And when Nick Ridley was told about this, he said, well, you know, if they're struggling to afford it, couldn't they sell a painting or something? And apparently he said it, you know, not ironically. You know, he would sell a painting if he needed a bit of money, because he has a whole load of, has an art collection, unaware that people working on the minimum, well, it wasn't a minimum wage back then, but on very low pay, don't have enough, they don't have assets.
Yeah.
So I think having diversity of viewpoint makes teams incredibly effective.
Which has been a really bad part of the pandemic, where the media have constantly attacked people for leaving their lockdown home, especially in the first one, on the beaches in Brighton or somewhere. I mean, it looked ghastly to me. There were so many people there. It just looked like, oh my God, and there was no toilets or anything. But we don't know how desperate these people were in their houses. I was feeling bad, and I've got quite a good life. So God knows what some of these people are going through. And then there's no empathy sometimes, I think, for what was happening. You've got the young people. You couldn't lock me up at 18 years old or 16 years old. I wouldn't have been happy with that. And then the very old people, which I talk about, who've got not many years left of their life and wanting to go out and go and do things. And everybody's hammering other humans who are deciding that they can't handle it anymore. And they're leaving their houses when we just don't know what their circumstances are like. What would we rather? They sit there and sort of, I don't know, end up in bed for 10 years because they're so miserable or something. No, they wanted to get out. And I found that really hard to watch. And I understood why people were piling on these people, but I found it lacking humility and empathy, definitely.
Well, I agree with that. And that's why I think that, having diversity of social class and social background in any political or the cabinet,
yeah,
or the senior leadership team at the Department of Work and Pensions. I know it's a kind of boring point, but unless you have that diversity, if they're all from exactly the same background, they're never going to come up with a policy that actually works for different people. And Tim, I've got to tell you, you mention this to people and they say, oh, diversity, it sounds a bit politically correct. It isn't. It's about making wise decisions. It's not necessarily... It's diversity of viewpoint, diversity of experience, diversity of the way of perspective. When I wrote a column for the Sunday Times the other week, and my wife said, "Hang on, you're writing." I like you, maybe. I'm sort of working class-ish growing up. Comprehensive school, mum stacked shelves at Asda. My dad was kind of a middle-ranking civil servant. He struggled a bit for money, but of course. It's amazing, actually, how as you sort of move up the income distribution. I had a Cockney accent. I kind of speak. It's my mum sent. I was at a table tennis club a couple of years ago, a new club. I was there to open it because I used to be a good table tennis player. And someone played a video of my first ever TV interview. And honestly, the whole place fell about laughing because I had a Cockney accent. And I realised that actually to fit in a middle class world, now I'm like pure establishment. I write for the Times and the Sunday Times. I do work for the BBC and Radio 4. And so I've actually adapted my accent and everything to sort of fit into that milieu. And, I think it's easy to forget where one has come from because one wants to fit in. And having some empathy with the different ways that people live, the different challenges people face. Now, I kind of have said that line, money doesn't make you happy. What a glib thing to say when you have money.
Tough, yeah, it is. Just quickly on that, I think I was told the other day that David Cameron, I haven't fact checked this, had the most members of his cabinet have gone to Eton. I mean, it's incredible in this day and age that we're still going down that road. And Harriet Harman, who I interviewed on this podcast, told me that when Tony Blair got into power, they just decided to put as many women in parliament as possible as MPs. And she said a lot of them just weren't, she said it on the podcast, so it's documented, but she said a lot of them just weren't qualified, but they went around and tried to help them. But that sort of getting the quota of women up 100, sadly the press called them Blair's babes, but it meant women were represented in parliament. It's so important. It's so important that we get someone from every walk of life represented in parliament. And I really agree with that.
And the other problem with Cameron's cabinet, a lot of them were very Eton-esque in their background, but also a lot of them were special advisors. I went to Oxford and did PPE for my sins. But a load of these people, they go from Oxford having done PPE, they go and become a special advisor, and then they move from there into becoming a member of parliament and then running a big government department. They've had no life experience at all. Yeah. You know what I mean? And unless you have that broad, I think that's been a massive weakness in British politics.
Yeah, well, I was talking to Andrew Marr about that the other day, and he was saying when he first started, most people, politicians, had had careers before they went into it, both on the Labour side and Conservative side, and they'd run business or done something. Now there's a lot of career politicians. The argument is always best for the job. I don't believe best for the job means best qualified. It sometimes means with diversity, with a different thought process to everybody else, is in politics case important. Just quickly before we get on to your book, like we've already been going for half an hour, because I can always just talk to you about loads of things. You mentioned football there and football clubs. I know you talk about a lot about you write a lot about sport. I don't think football during the pandemic has shone the best light on itself. I think it's seeming slightly ugly. I think we're all desperate for it, but Chelsea have gone and spent, right, we've got people losing their jobs and we've got pandemics and we've got everything. Chelsea have gone and spent 300 million quid on players. Like, we're just, I mean, it's my team, but it's like, who cares? We'll just carry on. We want to, you know, buy the league, as the other fans will say. But, you know, Man United have splashed cash. Everyone's splashed cash. Half the teams, and we're talking here, is exactly what you said. The idea of professional football, one of the ideas of it was so people could leave their houses and have somewhere to go to at a weekend, and it was something in the town, in the city. Some of these clubs, like Bury and other clubs, they're all going to go out of business. Football's not really looking after itself. And then as soon as lockdown, when we were going into the second season, suddenly BT and, or the Premier League did it, didn't they? BT and Sky suddenly went pay-per-view, which really backfired. There's an institution now which seems to have lost touch with its core, don't you think? Because
I think football, it used to be a community institution. Clubs often run in a benevolent way by local business people and supported by local people, a huge amount of social solidarity. They're now really global. I mean, it varies from club to club, but many of the big clubs are effectively capitalist enterprises, and they see themselves as producers of content, and they try and sell the content, in other words, the television picture of the match, all around the world, and extract value from the TV rights and from the merchandising. You know, the live gate is well under a third of the revenue stream now for the top football clubs. And so what they really want, Tim, you'll hate this. I mean, all of the American owners of the clubs, Liverpool, Manchester United, what they want, they think they have these assets, you know, the club and the players. And it's a waste of time playing Manchester United having to play against Burnley. They should be playing against Barcelona, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, you know, week in, week out. They want to have a European Super League with a salary cap for the players, so that they can then massively increase the equity value of these clubs. They're not interested and they're completely bemused by the idea that football is about anything else than making money. They're like, what? Isn't it a business?
There'll be some fans which disagree with me, but there's no way Chelsea-Barcelona will ever be as exciting as Chelsea-Spurs. There's not a chance. Chelsea-Spurs means a lot. And, you know, Man United, Man City, Man United, Liverpool, Leeds versus most of us. I mean, it's like Chelsea and Man United and everyone else, and Liverpool. But these are, like, Leeds came up and everyone's really excited because the rivalry's back. You know, they've got rivalries, such big teams. It doesn't go with Atletico Madrid.
Right, but you're grounded in a culture of English football and this wonderful history of rivalries. And when you see Leeds, you're thinking of the history of Leeds. You're thinking of this incredible story. You know, when you think about derby clashes, your mind goes back to the great clashes of... But what the Americans are thinking isn't of people like you. They think you probably will watch anyway because you're a big Chelsea fan. They're thinking about the untapped markets in India and China particularly. And if you can get, you know, Messi and Ronaldo, these people are big brands. You know, Barcelona has big global recognition. United has it. And they think that they're completely underexploited. So it's fascinating as a journalist. See, I didn't grow up as a football fan. So I see football fan. I'm on your side, by the way. I think it's a wonderful community institution. But you talk to the American owners or people who are very close to the American owners. They're talking it's like a completely different language. And they don't understand the fan psychology at all. They just don't get it.
It is incredible, but and I don't know where we go with it, because I remember tuning in to watch Chelsea and it was 15 quid and I was like, I'm not paying. No, I'm not doing it. And even though like I can afford it, I'm like, no, bollocks, I'm not doing that. And I'm texting my mates going, are you watching this European match? And they're going, no. So there's some of us who are going, oh, we're not interested. It's too much. But I think it's just, I think you're right. We're hanging on to the good old days, in our minds, the good old days, and football's moved on. Let's talk about your book, Dare to Be You. Interestingly, love it, by the way. I think it's a fantastic book. I wish I'd had this book around when I was a kid, because I think you cover a lot of ground in there, which would have been helpful for me. Can you explain the book to anyone who doesn't know what it is?
Well, look, that's incredibly kind. I appreciate it. It's quite intimidating writing books for kids, because you want to say things that are really useful and worthwhile, but you don't want to sound condescending or patronizing. So I've tried to do it in a really chatty tone, loads of illustrations, quite a lot of stuff about me. But it's kind of, you know, taking a step back, I just think that, and you'll know this, you know, in the world we're living in today, you know, kids really need to have, I think, you know, resilience. They need to be able to face up to challenges, occasional setbacks, you know, to be curious, to take occasional risks. And I think partly because of the social media, where people are worried about ever doing something that doesn't look perfect, kids stay in their comfort zone and they don't try new things. They don't explore all that life has to offer. So I'm just trying to tell the stories that, you know what, the biggest failure in life is just not to try and to retreat into a comfort zone where you're always going to look perfect, but you're never going to grow. And get, you know, people like you, you know, you've taken risks. You know, we're on air at the moment. Well, we're not on air. We're recording it. But whenever you're in front of a camera, something can go wrong. We talked about that earlier. You know, and that's true of, I think, anyone who's had an interesting and fulfilling life has had that capacity to occasionally make mistakes, to mess up, and to grow. And it's just to try and get kids in that mindset.
Yeah, you talk a lot about yourself in it, which is great, because you've had an interesting life, and at some stages you had to put yourself out there, didn't you? And I quite like the fact that you've used yourself, because you're a great example of how to get through life and actually come out of you were successful in sport and successful in writing too.
Yeah, so the background, so I've definitely had an unusual career trajectory, but also my dad, you know, was a Shia Muslim, came to the UK, he converted to Christianity. This is very unusual, by the way. Met my mum, you know, and the family were completely against their marriage, by the way. You know, your kids will be half-caste. It's a disaster. That luckily my parents decided to get married and have children anyway. But I grew up, I think, being quite ashamed of my colour, because I was the only brown kid in a all-white class. And I sort of used to dream of waking up with white skin. So that I think I realized that, you know, sometimes our differences can be huge assets. You know what I mean? When you think a bit differently, when you can draw on different experiences, you can bring so much to the world. And so one of the other things I say in the book is often we want to conform. We want to conform with the group. We want to do what everyone else is doing. Sometimes, you know, if you've got a voice or a way of behaving or something you really enjoy doing and it's not the same as everyone else, you know, do it anyway. I mean, think of you, Tim. You know, if you, I don't know how you think about your life, but I think one of the great innovations you brought to British culture was the football program, right? Soccer AM.
Yeah.
Right? So that was a massive innovation in how people think about football. You know, I think of it in the same way as Fantasy Football League, which again was a massive innovation in the way we thought about football, how we engage with football. You would never have been able to come up with that idea if you had just been sat your whole life in a Match of the Day studio thinking in a particular way. You brought something completely fresh. And I think we should nurture those great new creative ideas.
I will tell you, interestingly, the whole concept. Someone, The Athletic, wrote an article about this recently, actually. They liked the show, this journalist. But one of the whole concept was, I loved football and I thought football was fun. I love playing it more than I love watching it, by the way. But I love playing it and I love watching it. And when I went on Sky Sports, people won't agree with this, but it was true. I got told off to begin with, because I kept on saying I'm a Chelsea fan, and the bosses were going, you're not allowed to say who you support. You're supposed to be. And it started a whole era of people going, well, look who I support here. It's okay to support a team. And we just had fun with it. I watch football now, and there's very little smiling unless Roy Keane comes on and starts spouting his stuff, and then people start having a laugh then. But there's very few people smiling in football at the moment, and I'm not happy about that, because I've got so much pleasure out of football, and I think the whole culture around it is gone so serious. It's so serious today. We've got to win this match, or you know, we've got to talk about the. Where's the laughs? Where's the jokes in it? But anyway,
yeah, I agree with that. And actually, you know, if you think, one of the things I say in the book is you know, it's called Dare to Be You. Dare to be you. Be yourself. Find those ideas. Don't feel that you always have to conform. Be willing to take risks. And you know, I remember during the early stages of the pandemic, my daughter, 8-year-old Evie, she said, oh, my life has been ruined. She had been hearing on the radio so many people saying that there's going to be a lost generation. It's a complete disaster. They're never going to catch up the lost ground. That she had kind of absorbed these messages and had kind of decided that it was all a complete waste of time. And by the way, we've already talked about this. One doesn't want to diminish how difficult it has been for a lot of families, a lot of young people. But I think, broadly speaking, I think the tone has been a bit wrong. And actually, if you think about kids in the future, the world is going to change in all sorts of unpredictable ways, right? Because of technology and all the rest of it. And I think young people who are comfortable with change, you know, who embrace change, who feel that it isn't something to get really uncomfortable with, but actually who can face up to that, I think that's going to be one of the really important skills of the future.
Yeah, you talk about change. You've done a whole manifesto here. By the way, this book is so beautifully done because it's got diagrams and pictures and it's interesting. I mean, I loved it. I didn't put it down when I started reading it because it's so easy to read. And I think that's one of the important things, to get people into the book and then get them to consume it. It is easy to consume, but you talk about change, you talk about kindness, you talk about resilience, you talk about all those things that you need. And I think it's important. And the big thing you have, which runs all the way through the book, is kid doubt. And I think that is the most valuable lesson in the book, or one of the most valuable lessons in the book, because I've spent the whole of my life doubting myself. I still do it now. And it's like, you know, this person's behind me constantly going, well, you can't do that, Tim. You're not good enough to do that. And it's acknowledging that and moving on, isn't it? Are you confident now, or do you still have kid doubt knocking around?
I've still got kid doubt. You know, Tim, I'm really glad that connects with you, you know, because I think everybody has that voice in their head saying, you cannot do it. You're not good enough. You don't fit in. You're going to make a mistake. People aren't going to like you. And I wanted young people to understand that almost everyone has it. And you know what? The more you overcome kid doubt, the less that voice makes a difference to how you live your life. Because if you're passionate about something, I'm guessing on live TV, you still get a little bit nervous. But you know what, Tim? You don't look it to the outside world. You know, people watching you on Sunday brunch or Soccer AM in the old days. By the way, why did you... Anyway, let's go. But when they watch you, you know, you look completely assured. It looks like a walk in the park. But you know what? It took you a while to get to a place where you're able to do that. So in the same way, it took me a while to get to a place where I'm comfortable, you know, having a chat with a camera pointing at me or going on live TV. The first time, I was terrified. And I shook violently. But you know what? I think if you overcome your doubts, yeah, this is still there. You still have the voice. But my goodness, it doesn't stop you doing the things that you really want to do.
And the other thing which I love about the book is the resilience thing. I think we've got a bit of a problem, and I think we probably always had it, but you can see it more at the moment. We're older men, so we know that there's no man or woman who's going to come along in politics who's going to change our lives for the better. They might have a go at it, but we've got to do that ourselves. Whereas I feel that young people at the moment there's very much a culture. And Paul McGee, who comes to my podcast sometimes, calls it the victim culture, wearing the victim T-shirt. There's very much a culture of, this isn't right, whose fault is it? Generally, it could be yours. So you talk about in your book, which is great, is you didn't pass any of your GCSEs, but eventually you thought, I'm going to redo them, and you did them in your own time. You didn't blame your school or your teacher. I'm blaming mine, by the way. You know, you're never going to stop me blaming my school for that.
Tim, I think it's massive. I think it is so easy when anything goes wrong to point the finger at everybody else, anybody else. sometimes it's okay. You know, sometimes your school may have been absolutely terrible. You can legitimately blame the teachers. But I think self-reliance is such a powerful asset. You know, when I dropped out of school, I bought the textbooks, I learned the lessons, and went and actually applied to do the exams. You know, I had to write out a form. I had to take a tube up to Russell Square. I had to sit in a room. The local vicar had to verify my photo so they knew it was me sitting the exam. That was a massive benefit to me. And I've got to tell you, I think one thing, I don't know whether you'll relate to this, is I think one of the things that kids would benefit most from, it'll sound ridiculous, but, you know, starting a business. I'll tell you when I really learned a lot is I didn't have any money, but I decided I was going to try and run an events company. I'd put on a televised table tennis competition. And the amazing thing about doing that is you have to suddenly start cold calling companies to see if they'll sponsor the event. You're trying to learn about insurance. I had to conduct interviews to employ people. You had to learn about how to manage debt because I needed money as the initial capital. You know, you're suddenly trying to manage a whole range of things coming in. That gives you a lot of self-reliance, I've got to tell you. And I think, doesn't have to be starting a business, but giving kids projects where they decide what the project is. They have to solve problems. They have to ask questions. You know, as they get into their teens, that, I think, is how you develop a bit of self-reliance. And I think it's a massive asset for anyone who has it.
Yeah, and in your book, you give lots of examples of successful people in both business and celebrity, all sorts of things who have done it and have achieved great things. There's something I wanted to talk to you about, actually, because I know you've got a good brain, so I can, and you know you like sport. I worry about sports. Sports place in the world at the moment. I was very interested when I watched the Michael Jordan, and this is about your book as well, because we're always being told we should be winners, you know, this constant thing of we're going to be winners, win at all costs, be ruthless, cutthroat, all these sort of things. And then I was watching the Michael Jordan documentary. Did you see it? It was fantastic, wasn't it? But there's that one episode where they have the opposition going, yeah, Michael Jordan was horrible to me. And then they have his teammates going, yeah, he was horrible to me, but he's a winner. He's horrible. He's not nice. He's a winner, but he made us do this, but he's a winner. And most people that conclusion of that episode was that if you want to be a winner, you have to be selfish, self-centered, and, you know, don't mind trampling on everybody. That's what winners are. And everyone goes away going, yeah, that's what Michael Jordan is. He's a winner. By the way, I love Michael Jordan. But you can say the same for a lot of sportsmen out there. Then we end up with Trump getting more votes than he ever had. He was obviously got in power last time, and this time he's got more votes than ever. And everyone's going, he's a horrible man with no humility. It's like, no, isn't he what you want? Isn't he a winner? Isn't that what we're now producing in our politicians? Because we don't want necessarily the example, not necessarily is like have someone with empathy and lovely. It's someone who dominates their opponents. Isn't that what he's playing out? Just a little thought experiment here, Matthew. But it did occur to me that on one hand, we want it from our sportsmen, but we don't want it from anyone else, but we're looking for winners.
But it's interesting, Tim, that, I mean, look, I agree with everything you said, but when you look at the evidence of the people, oh, by the way, I think, you know, winning, it depends on how you define it. You know, what does a winning life look like? What does a successful life look like? It's one that we live and feel is meaningful and has great purpose and hopefully makes us happy. But I think that you look at the evidence, a lot of people who are successful today aren't like Trump. I mean, Trump definitely is successful in all sorts of different ways, but there's a lot of people who are successful who are empathetic, who are authentic, who are decent, who are collegiate, who try and help those around them. I think the younger generation sees this as particularly important in how they think about success in their own lives. And I talk in the book about the kindness cascade, because when you're quite kind to people, you create better, more meaningful relationships. People help one another. There's a great experiment in Belgium where the most Trump narcissistic medical students were the most successful in year one, where it was all about individual accomplishment and doing other people down. But by year six, it was the most collegiate who were the more successful ones because they were building really good friendship groups. What Trump did is he basically rose to the top, I think, by inflaming certain anxieties in American consciousness. But he didn't do it by building any relationships in the Republican Party, but he came to dominate the Republican Party. And you're absolutely right. There is a market for that kind of demagoguery. I think when a world is as it is today, it's a very fractured, polarized world where people within America, I mean, rural community. I mean, there's incredible division, Tim, in America. I mean, I think the Republic is decaying between the rural working class who voted for Trump in huge numbers and the more densely populated metropolitan areas that turned out for Biden. I do think, in Western societies today, there is scope for demagogues to win power with that very narcissistic, self-obsessed, cruel way of conducting politics. And it's a shame that we're in that place.
But yeah, but so the point I was trying to make was that this is what we have thrown at us constantly from sports people. You watch the documentary, Scottie Pippen was on a bad contract. Michael Jordan didn't go unless you sort Scottie Pippen out. I'm not going to... Yeah, he all the way through, he says, I'm nothing without Scottie Pippen. He just left him to rot. But that was Michael Jordan. Everyone's saying, that's great. Messi recently, one of the, arguably the greatest player we've ever seen, is going and holding Barcelona he didn't do a very good job of it, but he said, I'm not going to sign my contract. I want to leave. Ronaldo gets bored of United, goes and moves to Real Madrid, gets bored of Real Madrid, goes to, it's like none of these people are showing loyalty or our sports stars are just going. Well, I had Eden Hazard at Chelsea and his last season, he might not as well, he just shouldn't have played because we all knew he was going to Real Madrid. He didn't care. He was still our best player, but he didn't care. And I was like, why should I care about you?
But don't you think, Tim, that you can definitely pick examples of what you're talking about? And I do think there's too much individualism in team sports. But you look at the most successful teams of all time. They've had incredible collective work ethic, solidarity. The New Zealand All Blacks, an incredible group of people who play for each other. The star players sweep the sheds and there's an amazing sense of social. Or Jock Steen's Celtic in 1967, Liverpool in the...
The greatest of all time has to be Leicester City.
Right.
Because no, and you can't believe that happened. I mean, how did they win the league? There's no VAR to excuse or coronavirus or anything. They just won the league. And then they all left. Well, actually, Vardy stayed. See, Vardy's a good... He should be...
Vardy stayed. And by the way, Ranieri, I think it went to the head. Ranieri that season, they had an incredible... I mean, I remember going up and spending time with Ranieri. He was really interested in how to create this culture of collective achievement. I think once they got the flash cars in the Hollywood movie, I think they all started losing their sense.
Listen, I just want to ask you about one more thing because it hit me. The most poignant bit of your book to me was the fact you went to a football match and people started chanting racist chants at you. It's only a tiny bit of your book, but I was like, oh my God, Jesus, that must have been horrific for you. How did that feel when that actually happened?
So that's why I never really followed a football club in my So I went with Mark, my best friend, to Elm Park, Reading. You'd go get the 17 bus into town, and then you'd walk along, and you would see, as you know, when you go to a football match, there's people walking on the side streets to get to the stadium, and people started shouting out the P word. My first thing really was I felt so sorry for Mark, who was my best friend, who was having to endure all this. And he tried to pretended he wasn't listening to it. But I was young, and these were older people, adults, men. It was almost all men back then. And it was really difficult. My mum took me and my older brother, Andy, to Wembley to watch England against Czechoslovakia in 1981. And Viv Anderson was the first England player to play for England, first black player to play for England. And the N-word was everywhere, Tim. I mean, it was just incredible to listen. I wondered if you were supposed to shout the N-word because it was so prevalent. It's difficult to exaggerate, really, how it feels to be excluded because of one's colour. And, I would say this, that we talk about racism and it is still a problem. I've got to tell you, it's got a lot better. I think we should at least acknowledge that it's got so much better than it was in the 1970s, so much better. We've got a long way to go, but we have made progress.
I think, and I always think sport has helped that.
Yeah, agreed. Massively.
Yeah, because, you know, suddenly our heroes were black.
Right.
And that makes
I mean, look, see it on both sides of the Atlantic, you know, Jackie Robinson, the baseball player, first across the colour line, Muhammad Ali. In this side of the country, you're absolutely right. You know, fantastic footballers who began to change the way we thought about colour and race. And I think that's been a big positive.
Yeah, and interesting, because in your book, you talk a lot about Kevin Keegan and how you want to be Kevin Keegan. And you talk a lot about as a child, you want to fit in. So, you know, we can get on to how it's good not to fit in sometimes, but it must be horrible when you're forced to feel you don't fit in.
Yeah, exactly. I loved Keegan so much that I tried to grow the perm. I wanted to have a Keegan. Remember Keegan and McDermott? They had those incredible perms.
Yeah.
And one of the, so in the book, I say, you know what? It's okay to kind of copy your role models, like Kevin Keegan's work ethic and, you know, what a great footballer and his skill. You want to copy that, but we tend to overcopy. You know, we want to have their hairstyle and we want to use their aftershave. And, you know, that is probably not such a smart thing to do.
Fiona Murden did a podcast with me not so long ago, and she's got this book called Mirror Thinking. And it's basically, that is the way we learn, is by mirroring. And it's a great book, actually, because you spend the whole of your life trying to mirror people you're around. If you hang out with people who put on weight, you'll maybe put on weight. If you hang out with really fit people, you'll get fit. And it actually goes to, if you hang out with rich people, you'll get richer. You know, it actually works like that, and you mirror. And so as children, it's so important, because you do want to mirror everyone. But the point you make in your book, which is great, is you don't have to do that. If you want to be successful, you can step away and do your own thing. And I think that's really important. Otherwise, you know, I would have never got to work in TV. You'd have never been a table tennis player, you know, if we'd all just copied all our friends all the time. So very valid point. And the other book, the other podcast I've done recently is with James Doty, who's a brain surgeon, who talks constantly. He set up the Institute for Compassion in America in Harvard. So the kindness chapter you talk about in your book is so relevant at the moment. Compassion and kindness, and especially with the political environment we're at the moment, showing some compassion and empathy will make you successful, not just for you, but for everyone, won't it?
Yeah. And I think that's the wonderful link, that you create a situation where other people around you can get better. You mentor them, you help them, but they help you too. So it's kind of like enlightened self-interest.
Yeah. Hey, Matthew, it's really lovely to talk to you again today. Your book is great, Dare to Be You. It'll be a great Christmas present, won't it, for any young people you've got around you, because it just gives you the ability to, well, hopefully gives them the ability to think slightly outside the box and maybe go and give themselves a career and some confidence, which is the most important thing you can get as a young person, isn't it?
Yeah, and look, Tim, I love talking to you. We should do it more. Well, I should say we do it more often. Your listeners would get bored if I was on every week. But look, I've loved it. And, you know, thank you for being honest about the mental health. I think that's one thing that has been a real positive in my lifetime, is, you know, influential people being honest about their own vulnerability. I think it just makes it so much easier for everyone else.
Yeah, it's a tough thing, because I don't want to shove it down anyone's throat, or I don't want to use my mental health issues as a way of promoting myself for my career. Though that's why I do it on the podcast. I talk about it, and, you know, it has been, I've had some very dark moments, and especially during the last lockdown. I seem to be okay at the moment, though. So
good.
Fingers crossed. Your book will be great for any young people. It was good for me as well. Reminded me of things I need to do. Thank you so much, Matthew.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Tim. Yes.
Dear Lovejoy is written and hosted by Tim Lovejoy and produced by Blake Fallows. It's brought to you by Cooker, spelled Quooker. Check them out at cooker.co.uk. That's spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. If you want to get in touch with Tim, email dearlovejoy@gmail.com. And Tim is on Twitter @TimLovejoy and on Instagram @TimLovejoy_official.